This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Mel Harkrader Pine about his new book, From Pain to Peace, How Trauma and Tragedy Teach Us Compassion and Wisdom. How are you, Mel?
Good, David. I consider good my default state these days.
Well, I think it's often when we ask that question, we are not expecting a detailed, real answer that goes in, you know, that, well, I'm good, but, you know, I understand your state a bit, having read the book. And I should point out that I know it pretty well because I have helped you publish this book, or I have published this book. And I'm very pleased that we did this book together. I think it's a really powerful story, and I think potentially beneficial to a lot of people. And I would say, I think it's important to point out that you don't need to be a Buddhist. You don't need to know anything about Buddhism to read this book.
Yeah, I use only enough Buddhism in it because that's my practice. And I think a spiritual framework of some sort is helpful in recovering from trauma. I think the two big things in recovering from trauma is compassion for the self, which leads eventually to compassion for others. And if that's within a spiritual framework, all the better. And so I include enough Buddhism because that's been my practice for 40 years. But it's designed for anybody, and I try to include quotations and research from other sources as well as Buddhist sources.
And there is a section at the back of the book, and I think it's interesting you put it at the back of the book as a kind of introductory guide to Buddhism for someone who may be interested in it after reading the book, is how I would see that.
You know, when I talk to people, there are so many people. Well, the statistics are like only about 1% of people in North America consider themselves Buddhists. But if you go wider, ask the question more broadly, a lot of people have been influenced by Buddhist thought, and I put that at the end. Because, you know, if somebody was curious and wanted to know the basics as I lay them out, and I have a kind of a liberal approach to Buddhism, they have a starting point.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about how, I mean, there's a lot to talk about because this book covers a long period of time in your life, but maybe just to start, where did you become connected to Buddhism, and what was it that brought you there? And then kind of walk through the path you've taken. I know, really summarizing, because it's 40 years.
Yeah, you know, part of the reason I wrote the book is that my life has been punctuated by an unusual number of violent, unexpected traumas. Everybody has trauma, everybody has suffering, but my background is I'm sort of an expert in the midnight phone call or knock on the door to tell me that some really ugly tragedy has happened. So in the book, I have waves. Waves of trauma, and there's one that's brought me as close to a nervous breakdown as I've ever been, where I was sitting on the floor in my apartment in New York City playing Hey Jude over and over again on a boombox, because despite what I know about what Paul McCartney had in mind when he wrote that, to me, it's a prayer to St. Jude, a prayer to the patron saint of lost and hopeless causes. And the idea of Jude making it better for me was what kept me going at sort of my lowest point. And it was around the same time that I went, you know, every culture has a religion. I've rejected, fled from my religion of birth, which was Judaism. And again, I don't mean to badmouth Judaism. I grew up in the early 50s. I was born in 46 and grew up in the early 50s where some of the more gentle versions of Judaism were not available to me. Anyway, it was at one of those turning points that I almost, it's funny because I'd always been I talked about earlier about people who are interested in Buddhism. I've always been interested in Buddhism, but how does one practice Buddhism in the United States? You know, I didn't, it seems like something that's available only to people in faraway countries. But I began in my 40s to recover from my worst trauma in part by latching on to the works of Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a well-known Vietnamese born master of what's considered Zen Buddhism in Vietnam, but it's really a kind of a mild kind of mindfulness-oriented, live-in-the-present-moment kind. Enjoy every moment. I'll tell you the little thing I say every morning when I get up, which was written by him. Waking up this morning, I smile, 24 brand new hours before me. I vow to live fully in each moment and to view beings through eyes of compassion. And that's a pretty good summary of what he teaches. Later on, I got deeper into some of the more esoteric sides of Buddhism, but that was the basic framework that gave me a way, or helped me, along with therapy and all kinds of other things, that helped me out of my darkest period.
But you've also studied with Tibetan Buddhist teachers as well. And that I kind of reading your work and listening to you, I kind of feel like that's really more your practice.
Yeah, it's been 10 years. I had about 30 years of what I call mindfulness oriented practice. And then the last 10 years have been, I like to use the term Vajrayana, because to say Tibetan kind of ties it to a country where things are not too great now for Tibetan Buddhists. And a lot of the great Vajrayana teachers have moved from Tibet to India, Nepal, the United States. I'm more geared toward Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism. But also, the deeper I get into it, the more I go back to the original writings he didn't write, he spoke, the original teachings of the Buddha.
So do you feel that, I don't know, maybe this is something you would not agree with, but it has seemed to me that in modern America, many Buddhist practitioners are, like you, Jews who have fled Judaism, not fled it in total rejection, but have come to a different spiritual path. And you can you can be inclusive or different, you know, you can go one direction or you can do a kind of inclusive version of spirituality that allows you to still be Jewish, but also to be Buddhist.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the book, I talk a little bit about epigenetics and how we inherit things from our past. I think that Jews inherit, or there's something that becomes almost intrinsic that's difficult to accept Jesus, that's difficult to accept that person on the cross. And of course, you know, that changes as I get older and understand more. And I certainly see Jesus as a prophet, similar to the Buddha. But I think there's an inherent, I'm thinking of the word treif, the Yiddish word for not kosher. But when you're growing up Jewish and something's treif, it's like, oh, I better not even touch that.
Right.
And I think there's a certain reflex that's been built into the Jewish genetic code.
Well, it doesn't seem partly, at least from my experience, when you're growing up Jewish in America, you're kind of taught that you have to remember you're other, you're not the same. The dominant culture is Christian, and you have to kind of always be, you have to be yourself, and it pushes you away from all of the, like being able to embrace a kind of Christian view of the world, because it's contrary to what you were taught.
Yeah, I mean, it's easier to adapt to a minority, another minority. So yes, there is an unusual number of some people who still practice Judaism and also practice Buddhism, or people who have left Judaism and practice Buddhism. It's easier, in my opinion, it's easier for a person who grew up in the Jewish culture of, you know, 60 to 80 years ago, it's easier for us to accept the compassion of the Buddha than it is to accept the compassion of Jesus. Although, you know, we can eventually, you know, learn that's valid. It's just an inherent stumbling block.
Right. But there is, I think what we've evolved to maybe, or what a lot of people have come to, is a kind of a creative form of spirituality that says, or that accepts the value of all spiritual pathways, paths, and teachings, and maybe tries, and maybe thinks more of rejecting the organizational bureaucratic structures of religion to embrace the underlying spirituality of all religions.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's absolutely true. I mean, the more I know about Buddhism, the more I've learned about Buddhism, the more I see that same process going on in Buddhism, where institutions become hidebound, become self-perpetuating. When the Buddha taught that you want to test any teaching the way a goldsmith tests gold, don't just accept it. There's a famous sutra.
Does that mean bite it?
Yeah, right. I guess, I mean, the image of biting isn't a bad one, because it you put it through your own experience is what he advised, was take every teaching and evaluate, does it really lead to more suffering or less suffering? I mean, the Buddha was all about doing away with suffering, or at least reducing suffering to what's considered the first arrow. In other words, we all live with a certain amount of suffering. That's the first arrow. The second arrow is the stuff we add to it ourselves. Like, oh my God, this is never going to end, or when's it going to end, or oh, it was so much better yesterday than it is today, and so on and so forth. We, Buddhism is about not inflicting that second arrow on oneself.
Right. So I was going to ask you, I think there was one of the, I mean, this book, the book is full of really interesting elements that even if you don't end up ever practicing Buddhism, you can learn from. I thought that one of the chapters I really love the title of is called Being There While Getting There. And, you know, it's, that's sort of like a meditation almost, you know, that you just have to think about it and feel it as, what does that mean? You know, that you have to feel it out.
Yeah. You know, there are two, I mean, it applies to everything, not just spiritual wisdom. You know, we learn things cognitively, somebody teaches us, or we read it in a book, but it's totally different to experience and really understand. There are some things in my book about murders. It's one thing to read it, and I hope that people read it and learn something from it, but it's another thing to have lived through it and to experience the emotions directly. And that's, you know, there's a lot in Buddhism about, well, especially in Vajrayana Buddhism, the being there while getting there refers to being taught the view that we all have Buddha nature, the view that all we have to do is relax and get in touch with that Buddha nature, but we've got all this muck that's keeping us from getting there. So your being there is understanding intellectually the view of Vajrayana Buddhism. The getting there is the meditation, the experiential part of truly rocking it.
So throughout this book, what you're doing is telling your own story about, you know, not always terrible, but a lot of things that have happened to you that have been traumatic, and then integrating into that storyline how you worked through a lot of those things and how you have become able to make sense of them and to be a human being despite them. Whether I've summarized the book accurately or not, how do you see this as being useful to other people? Right? You know, that's kind of what I think the book is really meant for, that it's to benefit people who are suffering. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you feel about that.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant task to write all that down for people, to relive the things that I relive there. And I did that because I was hoping that people reading that will get some degree of hope, some degree of, oh, that guy's 80 years old and he looks back on all that stuff and he lived through all that stuff and he's living in a state of joy now. You know, that's kind of like why I introduced myself as, yeah, I'm doing good. That's my default state. So yeah, that's my hope, that people get some inspiration. That, I mean, there are so many different kinds of trauma. And, well, I mentioned in the book, another book by Frank Rogers Jr., who writes about unspeakable trauma, sexual trauma. That's something that I didn't have. But it's not all the same, but it's all the same process of experiencing, recognizing, you know, well, you don't want to deny it. It hurts, and you've got to go through the mourning. You've got to go through the crying or the mourning or whatever it is that's your way of processing it. But there is another side. I mean, a key thing with Buddhism is impermanence. Everything's impermanent. And, you know, that can be seen as a negative. Oh, everything dies. Trees don't live forever. People don't live forever. But on the other hand, the awful stuff doesn't stay forever, too.
Unless you want it to.
unless you wallow in it, yeah.
Well, no, I think that, I think what you just said about processing is really important. That I think people feel sometimes that, like, they're looking for a Band-Aid. They're, you know, in our culture in particular, every time you have a pain, you try to you take a pill. Or you know, if you have a physical ailment, you go to the doctor, you know, you have the symptoms, you get something, you want it to be fixed. People want to be fixed. They sort of we've created a vision of ourselves as if we are objectified. And what you talk about is much different. It's more like a holistic approach to a body. And, you know, if something is wrong, you don't just say, okay, let me have something to fix it. You have to work on it. You have to, you know, create a process.
Yeah, you have to first let the sadness be. There's no safety valve in just pretending it doesn't exist. And we all have our own processes for how to do that. I tell this story in the book, or actually one of my teachers, the way one of my teachers tells the story about a famous Buddhist teacher of the 11th century or so named Marpa. And there's a story about him, his oldest son's thrown from a horse and lands on his head and on a rock and is killed. And they bring Marpa his body, and Marpa puts a cloth over his head and starts weeping. And after a week of weeping, his students say, "Well, you know, you always tell us that life is an illusion, life is a dream. Why are you still crying there?" And he, you know, looks up from his cloth and he says, "You're right. Life is a dream, and losing a son is a nightmare." And he puts the cloth back over his head and goes back to crying for another week. And, you know, the idea is that even the most advanced, respected teacher recognizes that he has to live in the mourning. He can't just let it go. And the thing that I feel about that with my own path, from my own path, is that Marpa recognized in every moment that he would recover, that his default state was not crying, that was impermanent too. And that's the key. I mean, let it go, but recognize that it's not forever.
Right. Well, that is the processing of grief or the processing of pain. But I think it's obviously, if it was really easy to do, we would all do it. So as you mentioned earlier, we have this muck. I call it, you know, we have noise. I look at it almost as there's just noise. Our bodies are, and our beings are creating all this activity and energy that is not, it's on a different plane. You know, it's on the physical plane or in the, you know, in the, a different place than where pain is. And so we have trouble figuring out how to disconnect from the present and get into the place of impermanence, if you will.
Yeah, I think one thing I noticed about myself in one of these processes that I went through is, you know, I have this desire to share the story and tell somebody else and tell somebody else and tell somebody else. And I realized at some point that, yeah, you need a certain amount of that. You need to socialize it, to bring other people in, but you reach a point where you're just unnecessarily reminding yourself over and over again. And that's, you know, that's one of these things that you learn from experience, at some point you need to go, yeah, that was important for me to share that for a while, but you know, the details don't matter anymore. It's just grief. It's just sorrow.
Yeah, I wonder if we learn that or how we learn that. It's just, it seems like maybe it's true of all cultures because Buddhism is from a different culture than ours. I, you know, sometimes wonder about contemporary American or, you know, European style culture where we're so connected to materialism in this obvious way. That's the daily life is a materialist world. But then I realized, well, if it was just now and here, then Buddha wouldn't have existed. You know, this obviously has been going on for a long time in just in different ways. And we tend to think of our world as being super materialist. And, you know, well, maybe that's just the way the world has always been. That complexity has just, it's just our view of it is tenored by our experience.
Yeah, the Buddha lived 2,500, 2,600 years ago. And you read, I mean, I didn't immediately understand Buddhist suttas and sutras when I started. But as I got more experience, both experience in life and experience in Buddhism, and I read some of the early writings of the Buddha again, and I'm going, wow, how did he know that? And how can it be that people back then, that we still exhibit the same patterns?
Right. And I wonder sometimes, okay, what caused the world to create, you know, what brought forth a Buddha, a Plato, you know, the prophets of all of those years? And is the world producing them now? Are they just not, because there are so many more people now, you know, the prophets and the spiritual teachers may just be here and just not as influential because there are 8 billion people instead of a few million.
No. Yeah. When you think of what the world was that the Buddha walked around in,
yeah,
it's very different from today's. I also do think that there is, you know, that the greatest international scarcity is wisdom.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it may be that there are extraordinarily wise people who are living and we just don't notice them anymore. But I also can't help feeling that there's something about our cultures today that doesn't gravitate to wisdom. I mean, the Buddha taught in a period of where like everybody was interested in spiritual teachings. Teachers went around from village to village and, you know, got handouts. And
I think that's, you know, maybe that is, you've kind of put your finger on it, that people were moving around village to village, that a teacher could come to a group of people who would welcome that teacher, him or her. Today, there isn't, you know, there's just too many, like, who's going to be wandering around? And if they were, who would notice them? Because the wisdom does not necessarily align with social media and the internet.
Right. No, clickbait. Wisdom doesn't get you a lot of clickbait. Yeah, I mean, the story of the Buddha's life where he leaves, supposedly, I think a lot of the story is the story, and I don't know what really happened, but what's important is the story that lives on. And the story is that he left the palace and took off his robes and cut his hair and became a mendicant, which was not uncommon in those days. It was very common for people to beg and return and in return to give teachings. And everybody was interested in how one gets to enlightenment. And, you know, people considered life so hard that enlightenment was sort of the ticket out of rebirth. And yeah, I mean, you don't, I mean, you know, if you're walking down on, well, let's see, when I lived in, well, let's say 42nd Street, coming out of Grand Central Station in the morning, I used to see a lot of people who, you know, were sleeping there in Grand Central Station, and I would walk by them. If one of them got up and said, "Hey, you know, would you give me a buck for some wisdom?" You know, I don't think he'd get a lot of business.
Right. No, I think that may be the problem. You know, that we are just not able to recognize the crazy wisdom sometimes where it is to be found. Well, we could talk longer, but I think we've come to the point in where I have to end it. But I wanted to mention, and I think it's important, that you have written several other books. You've been working with AI, and as part of, when I write up the show notes, I will mention your Substacks, which I read weekly, about the connection between AI and consciousness, is how I would put it.
Yeah. I think my message that I'd like to leave everybody to think about in terms of AI is that, to me, the issue isn't what's in AI. Is it conscious? Does it really have feelings? The question about AI is, what kind of relationship are we going to form with it so that together we can build a better world?
Which is a good, I think that's a good approach, actually. We need to build a better world. So,
amen.
Thank you for that. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Mel Hargrader Pine. His book is From Pain to Peace, How Trauma and Tragedy Teach Us Compassion and Wisdom. And I've learned a lot from you. Thanks, Mel.
Thank you, David.